Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Oh, good morning to you, Menachem.
Menachem? Actually, I think I was named after a Menachem, but the name is Nachum.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
When did you change?
I don't know, but it would be good for you to learn this after a couple of decades of speaking on the air. Boy, oh boy. Must have been no sleep for you last night. These things happen.
Certainly very little.
Yeah, these things happen when you're exhausted, you know.
That's true.
Unless it's just a general, you know, the older years catching up to you. Maybe
I was
that's
actually
what
just reading something from an email before, so that's on my mind.
Here you go. He was reminiscing.
If you change your name, it would make it easier.
Reminiscing about your days with Menachem Begin, probably.
Actually, close.
Two conservative groups called on the Obama campaign to sever ties with a radical on its newly released list of more than 600 rabbis who support the president's reelection. The campaign rejected the demand. The RJC, Republican Jewish Coalition, on Thursday expressed profound outrage at Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, a renewal rabbi from California, that the RJC described as a radical rabbi, as part of Rabbis for Obama, which was launched Tuesday. Gottlieb sits on the advisory board of Jewish Voice for Peace, a group that is active in the campaign to use boycott, divestment, and sanctions to pressure Israel into ending the occupation of the West Bank. Malcolm, does the Obama campaign, or for this matter, any campaign, have the need to respond and have an obligation to get rid of someone like this?
It's not getting rid of. These are people who endorse a candidate. You know, it's part of the political season where everything gets caught up in this maelstrom of political charges, countercharges on all sides. We had the charges against certain individuals for their contributions. I think people make judgments. They have a right to expose the information, and people have a right to make a judgment. I don't think you can ask them to, you know, there were several hundred rabbis, I think 600 or 500 rabbis or people with the title who signed it. I'm sure they'll find disturbing things about others on the list who may have had associations, and I expect that Governor Romney will also have his list of endorsements. I personally find it distasteful to have the competing rabbinic lists, whether on local elections or on national elections. I think that there are polls that show that people get turned off when they're religious leaders, and not just Jewish, but of any stripe, get too involved politically and cross the line between what the people view as the role and the right of people to speak out on issues and rabbinic leaders or Christian or religious leaders of any kind to speak out on issues. But I personally don't like the idea of you know, they get 500, he gets 1,000, they get 1,500, the next one gets 2,000. Nobody knows who the people are, by and large, often. The campaigns, they don't vet the people, and you end up then with stories like this.
The reality is, as we know from the last election, that the association with clergy usually ends up being an important issue. Not important, a big issue, I should say.
I don't know how big an issue becomes unless there's a particular controversy and unless it's really linked directly to the candidate.
Right.
You know, where the candidate personally is associated with some view or associations, I think that does have more of an impact.
And this is an opportunity we have not discussed in a few weeks as an official topic. The whole effort that is referred to as boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, anything to tell us about this entire issue?
Yes, we're seeing in Europe increasing efforts. We saw the South African government now pass a rule where they're labeling Israeli products from Israel produced by settlers. They're trying to legitimize it.
Occupied but, Palestinian territory.
Well, saying it's produced in a settlement in the West Bank, which is
right, but that's how that's the three-word label they're recommending, right?
Right, and this is you know, an excuse for to find a legitimate way to engage in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, which has no legitimization really. And I hope people will protest it and will remember it when they make their own purchases. But this is a spreading thing. We see it being manifest in a number of ways that I think ought to be of concern to people. We have a number of companies, especially in Europe right now, but it's coming to the United States. We see consistent efforts. Most times it's been beaten back. But over the summer, the church groups, the Presbyterians, Episcopalians, others all tried to pass these resolutions, and some actually did pass the resolutions. I think the more disturbing trend that we see in Europe right now is the effort to ban Brit Milah, circumcision,
right,
which I think has always been the precursor for much worse things, that they attack Shechita, ritual slaughter,
right,
and Brit Milah. Because without those two things, which are feasible for governments to take action on, Jews can't live in that society.
I want to get to the circumcision issue in a second. Colleges are basically starting around now. Is there any group that you have noticed over the last year or two that's doing a good job on college campuses when it comes to BDS and trying to fight it down?
Oh, absolutely. There's tremendous efforts in California. But it's different groups in different places. Often it's a local Hillel. It could be a local student leader. It can be even the student government and the efforts that have been made to reach out to campus leaders and bring them to Israel and people who've gone on birthright have often taken on the lead in these battles. It's going on in a much more widespread fashion than I think most of our listeners and people generally tend to know.
Right.
And it doesn't make a headline unless it succeeds or close to succeeds. Remember, we had the problems in Rutgers.
Right.
We had problems on other campuses. And it's not just the BDS movement. It could be even some things that are more blatantly anti-Semitic. But this is, it's absolutely, they're probing all the time. They're trying to push this agenda wherever they find weakness. And frankly, we don't even know how many small campuses where there is no Jewish presence, you can pass a resolution like
that. Right. And on the circumcision issue, it seems to me that finally, people you'd expect to speak up are finally speaking up. And maybe it's just a coincidence of this trip to Germany with the chief rabbi in Paris saying what he said, meaning the president of Israel. Maybe that's what caught more of the headlines this week. But it seemed to me there was a complacency in the Jewish world when this all happened in that region of Germany, and that people are somewhat waking up a bit. Is that impression correct?
It is correct, but it wasn't just, it was also motivated by the fact that you had an actual legislative initiative in Austria, in local regions.
Meaning an arrest?
Pardon me?
Meaning an arrest, or?
Legislative initiatives to ban circumcision.
Okay.
But you also had charges now brought against a moel, a religious, a ritual circumciser, I guess, in Germany,
right,
brought by a doctor, and that really galvanized a lot of the public opinion. And certainly the officials in Germany and elsewhere have spoken out against this ban, but you have local support for it. And as I said, people, you know, have to understand that this is the symbolism and the symbolic significance is even if it's not legislated, but this is a way to attack Jews, doing it under the guise with Shechita of being, you know, fair for animals. They don't care about human beings, but they're fair for animals, and circumcision. And I think that it's imperative that we strike out against it wherever this arises, and the Council of European Rabbis and others have tried to respond in each instance to where this has been proposed. But you see it growing from Holland. You see it in other countries where it doesn't necessarily get that much coverage, but it even becomes an official position of some of these extremist parties.
I was speaking to somebody who lives in that region, you know, where Dusseldorf is the you know, city hall seat, so to speak, or the regional seat of that entire region, and he pointed out something to me which I thought was worth pointing out, and that is that the population of Germany is so different now than decades back that there are a lot more people who care on the positive side of this issue than there used to be. You're speaking to a different clientele now there.
To a degree, but the underlying factor here is that this is a way of limiting Jewish practices,
right,
and therefore Jewish life in Western Europe. We're not talking about now in some of the countries where we normally seen such, you know, under the communists, other places in the past. And I think there's a lot of pressure, by the way, on Israel to do more and on the Jewish communities and organizations in each of these countries to take a more assertive role to prevent these moves. This is
right, that speaks...
some people say that it's really directed against Muslims because the Jewish population in many of these places is minimal.
Right, but that's that point speaks to my, your first point speaks to my prior point, which is that I thought that there would be more of an outcry when one of the basic tenets of Judaism is attacked. You'd think, and by the way, this may help us understand the way things worked, you know, centuries ago. When it's attacked, sometimes you expect a reaction a lot sooner than you get. Now I think there's more of a Jewish public outcry.
Well, there is, but remember again that many of these places have minimal Jewish communities. It's not like you have a big Jewish infrastructure in some of these regions in Germany or elsewhere.
Right, but that's where Israel comes in. I mean, again, you know, now we see officials speaking up, but that's one of the, in my opinion, it's one of the reasons the State of Israel exists, is to get out there for Jewish interests.
In all of Europe, you have a little over a million Jews, maybe a million and a quarter Jews, in the greater definition of Europe. And as I said, and a point that people tend to overlook, is that this is, in some places, directed in the bans on circumcision, things like that, against Muslims. And when they ban kosher, they also try to ban halal.
Right.
And this is, but for us, you know, the significance, the singular significance of these two practices and the historic associations with the efforts to attack the Jews via these practices.
I was criticized last week for not asking you about the Agred missiles on Eilat. So now Eilat, as a major city in Israel, has the Iron Dome system, correct? The security defense system.
They have moved down more Iron Dome systems to the south.
So we've learned, number one, that it's necessary because Eilat's now a big target of the enemy. That's number one. And number two, why was I was under the impression that essentially the whole country is Iron Domed?
Well, because there are not enough units to cover the whole country yet. These are very expensive, and there is an additional aid from the United States that will help purchase more of them. I think $70 million more was allocated, and the president signed it to provide more Iron Dome units. But these are expensive. You have three parts, remember. You have the, for the long-range missiles, David Sling, then Iron Dome. And I think the IDF moved more units, both traditional military units as well as Iron Dome, to the south because of the developments in Sinai and the Gaza. And when the rocket started coming again, they obviously directed it, and they're put where they can protect major cities, especially the larger and more dense population centers, because most of the rockets end up, you know, not hitting in populated areas, and they can track it. Iron Dome's computers can track whether they're likely to hit where civilians live, and therefore save the rockets for those that are likely to be to do more damage.
What about important security installations, which may not have a large population, but are key to Israel's future survival?
I'm sure that is a serious consideration.
And they're under Iron Dome, you'd have to assume.
Well, Iron Dome and Patriots, you have a lot of, we have systems there that are deployed to deal with the different kinds of missiles. The problem from Gaza is that it's such a short distance.
Right.
And now we're seeing the development, both there and in the Sinai, which are raising hackles this week with the Egyptian buildup of tanks not approved by Israel. And Israel has demanded that they withdraw, and Egypt has sort of indicated they're not withdrawing them. The Camp David Accords, as you know, demand that everything be approved by Israel.
Right.
There's a buildup of troops, especially beyond the agreed-upon number. Which
so the radius of activity has been extended this week when it comes to Egyptian tanks?
They are moved to closer to the Israeli border.
Oh boy!
And here is the real issue: the reports from inside indicate that they're doing very little against the terrorist infrastructure. And places where they claimed that they had shootouts and stuff, people who were interviewed in these places indicated that they did not see any tanks and they didn't see any shooting. There are areas like Mount Halal where there's supposedly 3,000 fugitives. They're looking for 120, they say, people in this region. They've also demanded that Hamas turn over some people. There is coordination still between Egypt and Israel military units, representatives. They met six times in the last 3 days. The United States has offered them intelligence equipment to be able to monitor these things, but also said that they have to comply with the agreement with Israel. The danger here is that on one hand, Israel wants to see them, Egypt, step up its efforts against the terrorist infrastructure,
right,
and the units, but doesn't want to end up with a large collection of tanks under an Islamist army and government,
right,
that we see developing there. The al-Sisi, the head of the military, was in the Sinai offering a billion lira, Egyptian lira, to different sheikhs, because they're trying to win back the Bedouins, and saying if they control their areas, that they would provide more money. But in Sinai today, you see there are no judges, there's no infrastructure. It's all Salafist law, meaning Islamist extremist law, that is dominating. And there's a lot of concern growing even amongst the Bedouin now about the deteriorating circumstances there.
Is there an official Israeli policy then today, or a declaration, that they want Egypt completely out of the Sinai? They'd prefer that than this escalated activity?
No. First of all, they're allowed, even under the agreement, a certain minimal number of troops, because the Sinai was essentially demilitarized as part of Israel's withdrawal.
Right.
But so Israel is saying, we don't want you to put troops in unless you clear it with us, as the agreement demands. And second, that you'll agree to withdraw when it's when a particular measure or operation is concluded. And they have no assurance right now that that is in fact going to be the case, that they will withdraw. And the closeness now being demonstrated by Masri, the president of Egypt, with Hamas, saying in fact that we are one, Egypt and the Palestinians are one. Other statements, and the continuing harsh language that we hear from Egyptian officials against Israel, and the hints at breaking the accords. So while Morsi knows that if he would go out and say, I'm going to break the Camp David Accords, that's the end of USAID. There goes $1.5 billion and almost $2 billion and all sorts of other assistance. So this is a way to signal to his people that, you see, we're dictating our own future, without directly jeopardizing the aid. But I think members of Congress and others and the administration has come out strongly about this.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmam.org. Malcolm Holmline with us. Weekly update podcast information on our homepage. Go to the news section of jmandtheam.org. You're not going to like the fact that I'm bringing this up, I predict. But I'm going to anyway. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu condemned the brutal beating of a Palestinian teenager by a gang of Jewish youth shouting anti-Arab slurs. Though racially motivated attacks by both Israelis and Palestinians are not uncommon, the incident in central Jerusalem has triggered a wave of soul-searching among Israelis, particularly after one suspect expressed pride in his actions because the victim was Arab. You know what I'm going to say. It seems when things like this happen, the Israeli officials can't get to the microphone fast enough to condemn it, when, of course, Israelis have been victims to attack like this many, many times. Am I wrong to think this?
No, it's right. And that is the distinction between Israel and many of its neighbors, and most immediate neighbors. There was the release this week of the Incitement Index, which was instituted a year or two ago, to measure the incitement in which officials in the PA engage. And, of course, it's off the roof with the numbers of honors, again, for martyrs, quote, martyrs. The naming of a football tournament now for three of the killers of Jews. The attempted attacks, and thank God the vast majority are prevented because of the good work of the IDF and the Israeli security agencies. But it does say that there's a distinction, and when young people do it, if they're Jewish and attack an Arab, and we expect others to condemn it when it's the reverse, so it is important that the marker be put down. And it was done, by the way, across the board, by religious leaders, by political leaders, by everybody,
yep,
because this is not the way we behave, and it's not what should happen. But there does come a point where people sometimes take the law in their own hands in their own country and elsewhere. I don't mean these shooters. I'm talking about when people get frustrated,
right,
with the fact that they see these constant attacks, harassment, incidents, and And but that does not justify the fact that young people can give expression, engage in an action like this.
Well said. By the way, Morsi released that journalist in Egypt. I guess it's a publicity stunt, right? Because he's not really exonerating him. He's just letting him stay out of jail until the trial happens, correct?
Very good point. And this is really important because what I said on the air a couple of weeks ago, that the targets, learning from the examples of Erdogan and elsewhere, is first, they go after the generals,
right,
where they are the defenders of the system. Two, they go after the journalists. And three, they go after the judges. He's going after the judges now, trying to limit their power. But what is his first legislative act, as you say, is to say that these two journalists, he didn't free them, he didn't drop the charges. All he said is that they shouldn't be detained in jail while they're waiting the charges.
Right.
In the meantime,
right,
he's fired 50 editors. In the meantime, he's closed down satellite systems. In the meantime, they've arrested people who wrote critical of the president. And now he tries to balance that, or cover for it, by this relatively minor act, which says that they can be freed while they're, you know, waiting trial. And by the way, Morsi is expected to come here September 23rd for the UN session, and his presence this week in Iran, turning over the leadership of the non-aligned movement to Iran, which is a really critical development and issue, which we will discuss. We see that Morsi is very clever. They don't do blatant things like we discussed in Sinai. They do it in a gradual way, and there's supposed to be a big demonstration today in Egypt by people against the government and against the Islamization of Egypt and of the power centers, because he's taken over the military, he's taken over the parliament, he has the presidency, and now he's going after the judiciary. These are the only sources of power and control in the country. But many people feel intimidated. They're afraid, and the Muslim Brotherhood is very good at intimidating people while purporting to be democratic and responding to the needs. And he has done nothing about the economy. People are getting increasingly frustrated. They don't see him being able to deliver on anything that that he promised and the changes that he said he would bring, except in negative ways where he's put in power more and more of the Islamists.
Morsi meets with the President of the United States in September or not?
Yes, on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly here in New York. He probably will, by the way, and Netanyahu will be here as well, coming on the 27th for a couple days. And Morsi will be coming right on the heels of this visit, this visit this week with the to Tehran, and he said he justified it by saying that because Egypt was the chair till now of the non-aligned movement, he has to be there to turn it over to Iran. I mean, his foreign minister could have done it. He could have sent somebody else to do it.
Netanyahu shows up the 27th. That means on the 28th. A Friday, he'll be in this area. Maybe he'll join us for the weekly update, Mr. Homeline. Here's our opportunity.
He could give the weekly
update. Well, he could do that, but we can't take 40 minutes of his time. Maybe he'll join us for 5 minutes or so. Maybe you could arrange that. That would be a good ratings grabber.
I hope to see him this week, and I will tell you what.
That would propel both of our careers, wouldn't you think? It would do great for you and for Menachem. All right.
I think we'll both get caught in the propeller.
International nuclear inspectors, you just brought this up. August 23rd, New York Times, will soon report that Iran has installed hundreds of new centrifuges in recent months and may also be speeding up production of nuclear fuel while negotiations with the U.S. and its allies have ground to a near halt, according to diplomats and experts briefed on the findings. Negotiations, I mean, they grounded to a halt a long time ago. That's not new news from the New York Times. That's number one, right?
Right.
Okay, that's number one. Secondly, it's like a joke. You read this stuff, and the first thing I think of is you telling everybody told you so. Like, I mean, you know, 6 months goes by, and another 6 months, and another 6 months, and these deadlines continue to be extended, and now, you know, the newspaper of record is telling us, hey, here's the rundown of everything Iran has.
And the numbers are actually much greater, and that they are speeding up production all the while. You know, we're focused on what they're doing in Syria. We're talking about the non-aligned meeting, which is very important. I'll get to it in a minute. But the Iran supposedly has added 5,000 twin centrifuges to Akum and in Fordo. They're moving ahead. This is the underground unit. This is why the sense of urgency in Israel, because the window for Israel will close a lot earlier than the United States. Even General Dempsey, the chief of staff of the United States, said that Israel is in an existential threat, faces an existential threat different than the United States. They're right there. And for Israel, the ability to respond to it eventually becomes less and less realistic as they advance in this program and enter what I think was called the zone of immunity. And Iran is continuing. There's no let up. And as long as we hold out the promise of negotiations, as long as we talk to them about the prospect of the P5 plus one talks, they see this as giving them immunity to continue, and they hold out the option of renewing the talks when they have no intention of, and they have done nothing in all of this time to comply. And the most ridiculous thing was yesterday in the Security Council, Iran went there to threaten Israel, and saying because Israel's threats against them violates the charter of the UN, and wanted to see Israel held to account by the Security Council. When they're threatening every day to destroy Israel, talk openly about to wipe out Israel, Jews, the United States, every day, violation of the charter, and they have the chutzpah to go to the Security Council to complain. We know that they're enriching at 20%. We know that they advance this all the time, and the West keeps looking at this, and there will come the point, and again, there is a difference between the U.S. policy and Israel. Israel says they shouldn't have the capability, and they have to be stopped before they have that ability. The United States says having a weapon. But once they have a weapon, and once you can do it, they can turn it on at any time, and we know that they lie and that these sites are not subject to inspection. So, I mean, we're coming very close to that precipice that we have talked about for many years, and unfortunately people don't take it always so seriously, and I don't see the sense here of the urgency. In Israel, we're seeing much more. There was a massive drill by Hezbollah with 10,000 gunmen in 3 days, reenacting an invasion of Israel. People in Israel take this seriously, and you have more gas masks, you have other things being distributed, more efforts on the homeland front. But the Iran can do what it wants in Syria, sending in thousands and thousands of troops, and the international community can do nothing. They can host this meeting this week where leaders from 120 countries, not all of them will be there, but many of them will be there.
That's in Tehran?
In Tehran, 40 heads of state coming. Ban Ki-moon, in an outrageous decision which debases the UN and debases his own position, is going. Despite efforts by the United States and Israel, though very few others, to tell him not to go, that this is not his place, as Prime Minister Netanyahu told him in a relatively harsh exchange. But he said that he needs to, that all the past summit meetings of the non-aligned movement, which was established about 50 years ago as part of the Cold War, and these were the countries that were supposedly not aligned with one side or the other, and it's now become a movement of its own. So now Iran, for the next 3 years, is the chair. So when it gets up in the Security Council, in the General Assembly, or in the Human Rights Council, and the other places where they give all of these horrific, blasphemous, detestable speeches, they now speak also in the name of the non-aligned movement in 120 countries. It's simply so outrageous, and that heads of state, while the UN is condemning them for violating Security Council resolutions, for going ahead with the nuclear program, for their support of terrorism, the violation of human rights in their own country, let alone abroad, and what they're doing in backing Syria and the killings of thousands and thousands of people.
Right.
Now we're going there and breaking the isolation, having all of these leaders there.
You know what someone told me about you? That you've said that it is, that you continue to say, that it is unconscionable that anybody or any group that meets at the White House with the President of the United States does not bring up the topic of Iran.
First, and second, and third. And if we don't, with everybody, with every elected official, with congressmen, to get them to understand the seriousness. You know that on this show, for probably almost 20 years, I've talked about the danger of Iran.
More than 20, yeah.
And people, I know, often probably glazed over about it. and say, you know, why is he doing this? What is important? Public officials, President of the United States told it to me, just didn't get it, didn't understand it. And it's true now. We still don't see this sense of urgency. People don't take seriously. Dictators tell the truth. They tell us what they're going to do. They are warning us about what their intention is. And when there are meetings, and while there are other issues and significant issues, there is nothing more significant, and the message that's conveyed to public officials, if we don't raise it and give the sense of urgency, is this is not really, you know, it's the leader's issue, as I was told once by a president of the United States about Jerusalem,
right.
Because people don't raise it. They don't say it.
Remember that? About 10 years ago, we continued to stress that week after week, how the White House would say to you, hey, if nobody writes to us or contacts us regarding Jerusalem, why on earth would we think it's an important issue?
The first President Bush, after a meeting in the Oval Office where I raised the issue strongly with him, he let everybody leave, and he called me back, and he said to me, you know, this issue of Jerusalem, this is your issue. It's not an issue in your community.
Right.
I said, Mr. President, how can you say that? It's the one issue which unites us all. Da, da, da. And he said, because I never hear from them about it.
Unbelievable. All right, finally, let's get to two quick things. Well, I don't know if we do these quickly. Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, I've said many times that it would be much wiser if he silenced himself on certain issues. He's called for the ouster of Abu Mazen. What does he expect, that the Israeli government could actually facilitate such a thing?
Well, he's sort of moderated it since then, but and if you read the full context of his speech, it's not really the way the media has isolated those comments, you know, as they say, taking him out of context. But he was trying to communicate a message. This guy does not want peace. This guy is not doing anything positive. He is going to go to the UN. We expect him to issue a call for unilateral recognition via the General Assembly, as he did try to last year with the Security Council.
Right.
We see that in the West Bank and in the areas under the PA control, they've done nothing for employment. The corruption is so widespread. 70% of Palestinians think that their administration is corrupt. Israel, by the way, I don't know if you know this, is going to issue 10,000 more permits for Palestinians. 80,000 Palestinians work in Israel and the West Bank settlements. And it also points up the hypocrisy of all these boycotts of West Bank products, when in fact, in all the Palestinian areas,
right.
Gaza and the West Bank, you see all of these products, and Palestinians are being employed
by them, right?
in all of this. All the money that is being sent there for these economic development programs are ending up in the pockets of Abbas, his sons, and others, and so the corruption there, and amongst Hamas as well. When you look at the number of civil servants and how they give out the jobs, I mean, it's all the same corruption as ever, and he's doing nothing. And I think what Lieberman is trying to point out is to say, look, you can't have a guy who's leading them nowhere, and in the meantime, engages in incitement and does and refuses all of these entreaties to talk.
All right, Lieberman makes a good point. Question is about how he makes it. All right, finally, I know it's hard to do a Syria update in 2 minutes, but significant to bring it up this week. Apparently, the President of the United States, and you can confirm this for me, has said that if Syria does resort to chemical weapons, he is prepared to use military force. It sounds like Great Britain and France are saying the same thing. This is a significant development, no?
It's a significant development where we give public expression, specific expression, but the United States has been working on this for a long time, along with some Europeans and others in the region, because this is a unique danger, the idea that Hezbollah or Iran get their hands on all of this massive amount of chemical and biological weapons, probably the biggest stockpile of these weapons in the world, and you have troops there, but with the defections and changes there, there are a lot of people who are skeptical about the ability to control it. It will take thousands of troops, they say, to move in. The Russians were reported to have said that they had assurances regarding the control over the weapons. Yesterday they came out, or last night, and said that, in fact, they have no such guarantee about it. And the concern escalates when the number of Hezbollah troops and 15,000 Iranian troops supposedly in Syria today, and the ability to take these weapons. Now, again, it's not so easy to weaponize them and to use them, but, you know, the very idea that these chemical or biological weapons would fall into the hands of, they are in the hands of a rogue regime, but they fall in the hands of these terrorist entities,
right,
would be of great concern. And I think you see the concern, by the way, spreading, because the ease with which, let's say, they could take him to Lebanon. You've had fighting this week in Lebanon, and an issue I know people don't focus, but the fighting in Tripoli for 3 days is very serious. It's perhaps a precursor of a civil war after whatever happens with Assad happens. The Sunni-Shiite battle, it's all about it in the future, but it's a much more serious matter, I think, than people know, that you've had these kind of clashes, and it tells you also about the clashes that's taking place within the entities and the growing power of the Islamists in Syria. Look at who today is the spokesman when media interviews people. Look at who, you know, those groups that played a quiet role in the past, but you have Al-Qaeda and you have other kinds of Islamist groups now. They're not really all coordinated and tied together inside Syria. You don't have a unified opposition, but you have the growing presence and visibility, which means that if the government or the situation that develops such that Assad falls and you have all these little fiefdoms, you will have the chemical weapons inside those areas as well.
No question. Wow.
And this is a long-term issue that is of has to be considered. The implications of it are pretty scary.
Imagine what the Prime Minister of Israel is going through with all this surrounding him. Just take Egypt, Syria, and Iran. Forget about all the others and all the different things he has to deal with.
And Lebanon with Hezbollah.
Right, which is an extension, really, of what's happening in Syria, right?
Well, it is in part an extension, but, you know, the infrastructure of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon is huge. And they dominate it. You have hundreds and hundreds of villages where they're present. You have massive infrastructure and especially underground networks where people can live for weeks. They have hospitals. They have all sorts of things built underground today.
Right.
And this is obviously for Israel a major concern. And the idea that if Israel needs to act against Iran, the front with Hezbollah obviously becomes a primary concern.
I
hope to see the Prime Minister, and next week we'll not talk about what he said.
I'd like to.
I will tell Menachem about it.
Yeah, work on the 28th. I need to express this to him publicly. I need to let him know that there's some people out there in the Jewish world who really appreciate the unbelievable stuff that he has to deal with on a daily basis. So let's see what we could do.
Exactly. It's that's what I always say, and people, you know, look at me like I'm weird. I said I wouldn't want to be prime minister for 5 seconds.
Exactly.
President of the United States, you get a lot of perks. You know, there are a lot of good things. Prime Minister of Israel, you get tsaras.
Exactly.
And, you know, you're constantly under pressure, and you have to realize that every decision affects the future of the state and of millions of people. The President of the United States can make mistakes as they have.
Right. I'm sorry for laughing, but I believe it was Danny Hoberman who did this at the Nefesh B'Nefesh, the one that just landed in Israel last week. So the Prime Minister came. So he said something like, I'm paraphrasing, he said, to introduce the Prime Minister, he said, and now a man who has mixed feelings about today, because he's getting 360 new citizens of Israel, but he's also getting 360 new people who are going to tell him what to do. Something like that, I don't remember exactly.
That's true, you know.
Very difficult.
7 million presidents.
Exactly. All right, Malcolm, you're around next week.
God willing.
Labor Day weekend, you're working? Holy cow.
Listen, this is not a time when...
No time off now.
Unfortunately.
That's it. All right, thank you. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Weekly update Fridays, 7:40 Eastern Time here at JM and the AM.